This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, in anticipation of the conventions, we're looking back in time and featuring interviews about presidential history and politics. We expect newly elected presidents to assemble cabinets that reflect the president's positions. Abraham Lincoln took a different approach. He brought into his cabinet three powerful men who had politically opposed him. How and why he did it is the subject of the book Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln, by the Pulitzer Prize-winning presidential historian Doris Kearns Goodwin. She writes, "In my own effort to illuminate the character and career of Abraham Lincoln, I have coupled the account of his life with the stories of the remarkable men who were his rivals for the 1860 Republican presidential nomination: New York Senator William H. Seward, Ohio Governor Salmon P. Chase, and Missouri's distinguished elder statesman Edward Bates." Lincoln appointed Seward Secretary of State, Chase Secretary of the Treasury, and Bates Attorney General. I spoke with Doris Kearns Goodwin about Lincoln in 2005. Your book is called Team of Rivals, and it focuses on cabinet members who were his rivals, who actually wanted the nomination for president from the Republican Party. Why would he choose his rivals to be in his cabinet?
I mean, it seemed at the time an unprecedented act because people hadn't done that in previous years. And these men were not only his rivals, but they were so much better known than he was. Seward had been the governor and senator from New York. He was so much considered the possibility of being the person who would win the nomination that 10,000 people were waiting outside his home in Auburn to celebrate. The champagne had already been stocked in the local restaurants. And he thought when he was made Secretary of State that he would actually run the show and Lincoln would be just simply some sort of puppet. But in fact, Seward and he ended up becoming great friends. I think Lincoln had an internal confidence that even though these men thought they should have been president, similarly Chase of Ohio thought he should have been president, Bates of Missouri, an elder statesman, Stanton, who eventually becomes Secretary of War, had humiliated Lincoln once when they were young lawyers together. But he was able to put those past rivalries beside him, knowing that if these guys do a good job, then it will only be down to the interest of the country and obviously to his own interest as well. And it meant that he had to have, much more than they realized, a sense, I think I can handle these guys. I can master them. And
what,
he did.
What do you think Lincoln did to bring together this cabinet of rivals?
Well, what he had going for him, which I think is so unusual in political life, is that he had a set of emotional strengths that today we might call emotional intelligence. So when all sorts of rivalries sprung up with these guys, and when they got hurt with one another, when they would call each other names, I mean, if we ever heard what they were calling each other then in today's parlance, liar, traitor, thief, I mean, and these things are being said in cabinet meetings, but he was somehow able to be in the center of that storm. When one of their feelings would be hurt, he'd be able to write a letter saying, if I hurt you in any way, I did not mean to do so. Forgive me for things that I might do hastily. When he was upset with somebody, he would write what he called a hot letter, where he would write it all down, and then he would put it aside until his emotions cooled down, and then write, never sent, never signed. And there was a sense about him where he was just kind and sensitive to them. If one of them was feeling he was spending too much time with another one, he would call that one aside and give him a special time to walk together or to go on a carriage ride together. So what he essentially did is what a great politician does, which is to understand that human relationships are at the core of political success. And he somehow managed these people who, as I say, oftentimes hated one another, wouldn't even go into the same room with each other after a while. Stanton and Blair, his postmaster general and his secretary of war, said such terrible things about each other that Blair would never even go to the War Department, even though he wanted to find out what was going on in the battles. It's almost unimaginable that he was able to keep this group together, but the success in keeping it together meant they also represented very different spectrums of political opinion, from very conservative to moderate to radical. And as long as he could keep that coalition together by keeping these people inside the tent, he was actually keeping those strands in the country together as well.
What was considered radical then?
Well, what was considered radical then was the idea that early on you wanted to make emancipation the central focus of the war. And then later on, even after emancipation was made the focus, the radicals were more desiring to make the South pay for having gotten us into this war in their judgment, and to wreak vengeance on them in order to be able to make sure that the old social structure would not come back in the South, whereas the conservatives were thinking that the Union was more important than emancipation. And also at the end of the war, they wanted to make sure that the South came back in a more gentle way so that the Union would be preserved, even if it meant not punishing the leaders of the South who had been part of the Confederate cause.
And where did Lincoln stand?
Well, Lincoln stood in the middle on all these things. I mean, naturally in the middle, not because he was positioning himself in the middle. At the start of the war, he thought that the Union was the most important thing, and that emancipation, he wasn't sure, was something that he as president could do anything about, much as he might have wanted to, because it was in the Constitution protected. So he thought the most important thing was to get a constitutional amendment to eradicate it, which he eventually did. But by the middle of the war, he came to understand that as president, he would have powers as commander-in-chief when a military necessity was at issue to be able to do something about the slaves. And the slaves were being used to help the South. They were digging the trenches. They were acting as cooks. They were protecting the home front when those soldiers went off to war. And they just unbalanced, gave so much benefit to the Confederacy as opposed to the North, that he finally was able to decide legalistically that if he issued a cry for the emancipation as a military necessity, he would have that power to do it. Eventually, you'd need a constitutional amendment. So he moved toward what might have been the radical side. On the issue of Reconstruction, I think even by the time of his death, however, he did not want to have vengeance against the South. But he would have been worried about protecting the rights of blacks, which they were also worried about. So he probably would have been in the middle on that ground as well.
What did he do to hold together this group of people within the cabinet who had such differing views about what the fate of the South should be and what emancipation should look like?
Well, I think partly what he did was to move step by step toward emancipation. You know, just as Franklin Roosevelt moved step by step toward getting us more involved in World War II, even before Pearl Harbor, by Lend-Lease, by the peacetime draft, Lincoln began to move toward certain steps that would allow the Army, for example, if slaves came into the Army camp, to take them into the camp and keep them protected from the Southern slave owners. And these steps allowed him to move some of the conservative members to see, well, we did that, and it didn't produce some sort of race war, because the conservatives were always afraid if you emancipated, there'd be this incredible servile war in the South, so that it got them accustomed to the idea. And finally, however, the interesting thing is when he finally made the decision to emancipate the slaves, he called his cabinet together, and he told them, I want to tell you what I've decided, and I will listen to your comments, but I want you to know I've made this decision. I think he finally knew that if he put it up to a vote or a discussion, then it might make it harder for these people to understand that this was his decision. And the only thing he did was he accepted their thoughts on the style of it. He accepted Seward's advice that he not issue it. He was going to issue it in the summer of 1862, and the war was going very badly for the North. And Seward said he thought it would look like he was just desperate and that it wasn't an act of considered opinion. Why not wait for a victory to issue it? And Lincoln took that into consideration, agreed with Seward, and waited until the Battle of Antietam was fought and successfully resolved before he finally said he was going to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. So I guess in some ways what it meant was he listened to them as he was going along, but he finally had to decide for himself what he was going to do and then just tell the cabinet in a very forceful way, this is what I'm going to do. I'd like you to think about it, but it's my decision.
What happened to these cabinet members that you write about, the team of rivals, after Lincoln was assassinated?
Oh, it's so interesting what happens to them. I mean, first of all, Chase is one of the more interesting pieces of the story. He was one of the few cabinet members who never did accept Lincoln's primacy. So even in 1863 and 1864, he was plotting to run against Lincoln for that second nomination so that he could beat Lincoln and become the president. Lincoln knew everything he was doing. He was aware. Lincoln had incredible tentacles, so he knew what was going on. But he somehow kept him inside the tent rather than letting him go outside. And then finally Chase did resign from the office of Secretary of Treasury. He had embarrassed himself in many ways so much because it became known what he was doing against Lincoln. But then in the fall of 1864, after Lincoln had won the election, he appointed Chase to the vacancy that arose in the Supreme Court when the Chief Justice died, giving him the highest position on the Supreme Court, even though he said, I'd rather swallow a chair than do this to Chase, who he didn't like. But he knew that Chase, who was an abolitionist, would be the best protector for the rights of the newly freed slaves.
Well, William Seward, Lincoln's Secretary of State, wasn't he shot during the assassination?
I hadn't fully realized what happened to William Seward. During the assassination attempt, John Wilkes Booth really had a triple assassination in mind. He wanted to get Seward, the Secretary of State. He wanted to get Andrew Johnson, the Vice President, and, of course, Lincoln. So he took Lincoln on for himself. The person who was supposed to kill Andrew Johnson chickened out and didn't go to Johnson's hotel. But the man who was assigned to Seward went to Seward's house at Lafayette Park, and he managed to get inside. Seward had had a carriage accident about a week and a half before, and his jaw had been broken. He was up in a bed, so he pretended he was bringing medicine up to Seward. But Seward's son understood that something was wrong as he barreled up the stairs and tried to stop him. He then took the blunt end of a revolver and hit Seward's son, who was his assistant secretary of state, on the head so badly that he was in a coma for days. He then took out a knife and slashed two or three other people, came into the room, slashed Seward's entire cheek off, and just happened to miss the artery that would have killed him. And he then ran out and slashed another couple people on the way out. So it was one of these extraordinary moments in Seward's family life. And however, he somehow managed to pull through. And in fact, his son also came out of the coma and pulled through. And the incredibly sad thing was that his wife, Frances Seward, who was torn apart by the thought that she was losing her son and her husband, was so tense. And she wrote an article in which she said, "I've never before believed in vicarious suffering, but I think somehow that my son and my husband are getting well, and I've taken their suffering onto myself." And in May, only a month or so later, she died, and no one knew quite what she had died from, and she was not an old woman. So that the Seward family was forever broken by that event. But the part I think that got to me the most emotionally was that they didn't want to tell Seward that Lincoln had been killed, knowing how close friends they were. So they kept the news from him, but finally he looked out the window and he saw the flag at half-mast, and he turned around. He said, "I know Lincoln is dead." They tried to say, no, that's not true. He said, "I know he's dead. If he were alive, he would have been the first one here to see me after my knife attack." And then great tears coursed down his cheeks, and he knew then his chief was dead.
A recent book about Lincoln says that he was gay or bisexual. I haven't actually read the book, so I confess. So I'm not sure which it asserts, but have you reached any conclusions about the president's sexual orientation?
Well, one of the great things about the comparative perspective is when you see something like somebody claiming that Lincoln was gay, you can look at what the evidence is and look at it in relationship to all these other guys as well. For example, it is said that because he slept in a bed with his best friend Joshua Speed for 3 years, that that's one indicator of the possibility that he was gay. They also point to letters that Lincoln wrote to Speed, which were quite affectionate and full of a feeling, of intense feeling. But if those are the measures, then almost all my guys, as I sometimes call these cabinet members, would be looked at as being gay, because it was very common for men to sleep in beds together. In fact, when Lincoln was on the circuit in Illinois, they would all travel around the state together, the judge and the bailiffs and the criminals sometimes and the lawyers, and they'd stay in the same boarding houses where there weren't enough beds. So sometimes two or three lawyers would be in a bed together. The only one who got his own bed was the judge because he weighed over 300 pounds, so no one could be there with him. And then when I looked at the affectionate letters that Lincoln wrote to Speed, his friend, they were nowhere near the intensity of some of the other letters that I found. For example, when two of his cabinet members, Chase and Stanton, were young men in their 30s, they had both lost their wives and were very lonely and became very close friends. And I found these letters that Stanton wrote to Chase at the time saying, "Since our pleasant intercourse last summer, no one has been on my mind more waking and sleeping. I dream of you at night. I can't wait to sit by the fire and hold your hand and tell you I love you." Similarly, Seward, when he was in the state senate in New York, formed a friendship with another senator who wrote to him saying, "I have positively womanish feelings for you. I miss you when you're not here. This is not the right thing for a grave senator to be talking about. I do not think any charges were ever made or any thoughts that these other men were gay." And I think that just means that men were more free in that age to express their deep feelings for one another. There was very little friendship between men and women because women were so chaperoned, so that women and women formed very close friendship. Men and men formed close friendships. And I think it was just an age where I wish almost we had it today, where men could really express those feelings as openly as they could then. But I don't think that we can imply from that sexual contact or sexual intimacy was the end result of those letters or the sleeping in the same bed.
Now that we know so much more about depression than we used to, historians are starting to examine how, you know, depression may have affected important figures, including Lincoln. Do you have any new thoughts about what you describe as, melancholy temperament and how that affected him as a leader?
I came away feeling that rather than suffering from chronic depression, that Lincoln did have a melancholy temperament from the time he was born. There's a writer named Jerry Kagan who studied children from the ages of 0 to 20 and argues if you look at them even 3 months, 6 months old, you can divide them into whether or not they have a melancholy or a sanguine kind of optimistic temperament. And clearly, I think Lincoln had that melancholy temperament. But he also had enormous resources all the way along to figure out how to get himself out of his sad moods, humor being one of them, conversation. During the Civil War, he would go to the play when he wanted to. He went to the theater 100 times during the Civil War, if not more. He would go to the battlefront when he felt sad over the loss of a battle to talk to the soldiers. He had an acute awareness, I think, of his own needs. And except for two depressions, which we know about, one when his first love, Anne Rutledge, died, which it's natural for somebody to fall into a depression, and secondly, there were a series of events that took place when he was in his 30s. His best friend, Joshua Speed, was leaving town. His political career had suffered a blow, and he had broken his engagement to Mary Todd Lincoln. And he really did feel overwhelmed then by depression. And we have letters that he wrote saying that he was the most miserable man on earth, and that if everybody felt like he did, there would not be one cheerful face on earth. And he actually was so frightening to his friends that they removed all razors and scissors from his room, fearing that he might take his life. But his best friend, Joshua Speed, came to his side and said, "Lincoln, if you do not rally, you will die." And he said, "I would just as soon die now, but I haven't done anything yet to be remembered by." He had this dream from the time he was young that he was so fearful of just dying and turning to dust that somehow if he could accomplish something great, this is the way the Greeks used to think, your name would be remembered after you die. And that powered him through the early losses of his childhood. It powered him through his early days in the state legislature, and it helped get him out of this depression. And the great thing is that many years later, when he finally signed the Emancipation Proclamation, Joshua Speed came to see him, and he said, "Well, Speed, remember that conversation we had when I was in my depths? Well, maybe at last my fondest wish has been realized. I will be remembered after I die."
Well, Doris Kearns Goodwin, thank you very much for talking with us.
You are so welcome. It's a great pleasure to talk to you again.
Doris Kearns Goodwin recorded in 2005 after the publication of her book Team of Rivals, The Political Genius of Abraham Lincoln. By the way, on tomorrow's show, when we continue our series of interviews about presidential history and politics, we'll hear from former press secretaries representing each president from Reagan through George W. Bush. And we'll talk about some of the tough spots they were in, like this confrontation between Helen Thomas and Scott McClellan in an October 2005 White House briefing.
President Meade, what do you mean by total victory? That we will never leave Iraq until we have total victory. What does that mean?
Free and democratic Iraq in the heart of the Middle East, because a free and democratic Iraq in the heart of the Middle East will be a major blow to the ambitions.
If they ask us to leave, then we'll leave.
Okay, I'm trying to respond. Well, a free and democratic Iraq in the heart of the broader Middle East will be a major blow to the ambitions of Al-Qaeda and their terrorist associates. They want to establish or impose their rule over the broader Middle East. We saw that in the Zawahiri letter that was released earlier this week by the intelligence community. Well, Helen, the president recognizes that we are engaged in a global war on terrorism. And when you're engaged in a war, it's not always pleasant, and it's certainly a last resort. But when you engage in a war, you take the fight to the enemy. You go on the offense, and that's exactly what we are doing. We are fighting them there so that we don't have to fight them here. September 11th taught us.
Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11.
Yeah, well, you have a very different view of the war on terrorism, and I'm sure you're opposed to the broader war on terrorism. The president recognizes this requires a comprehensive strategy and that this is a broad war, that it is not a law enforcement matter.
Sorry, on what basis do you say Helen is opposed to the broader war on terrorism?
Well, she certainly expressed her concerns about Afghanistan and Iraq and going into those two countries. I think I can go back and pull up her comments over the course of the past couple of years.
And speak for her, which is odd.
I said, no, I said she may be, because certainly if you look at her comments over the course of the past couple of years, she has expressed her concerns. She has expressed her concerns.
Scott McClellan, and he's one of the presidential press secretaries we'll hear from tomorrow. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Presidential candidates and presidents weren't always expected to talk about their faith in public. In the book God in the White House, Randall Balmer traces what he describes as the politicization of religion and the religionization of politics. He examines how faith shaped the presidency from John F. Kennedy, who argued that being Catholic was irrelevant to his qualifications as president, to George W. Bush, who described Jesus as his favorite philosopher. Balmer considers himself an evangelical Christian whose understanding of the teachings of Jesus points him toward the left of the political spectrum. Balmer is a professor of religious history at Barnard College and Columbia University. He's editor-at-large for Christianity Today. His book, Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory, A Journey into the Evangelical Subculture, was adapted into a PBS documentary series. I spoke with Balmer earlier this year when God in the White House was published. Now, your book starts with JFK, the first Catholic president. During his campaign, he argued that religion wasn't a legitimate criterion for choosing a president. Was faith typically discussed by presidential candidates then?
It wasn't all that common for presidential candidates to really talk about their faith in kind of personal, confessional terms. And I think the reason for that is simply that most Americans assumed that a candidate would have some sort of faith, and most Americans assumed that it would be a kind of generic Protestant faith. When Eisenhower ran in 1952, for example, it came out in the course of the campaign that he had never been baptized as a Christian, and his response was, well, as soon as the campaign is over, I'll get around to it. Can you imagine a candidate today saying something like that?
So how did Kennedy try to neutralize the religion issue during his campaign?
Kennedy, as he was gearing up for the 1960 campaign, recognized that the religious issue, as it was known then, would be an issue in the campaign, and there were several reasons for that. Of course, you have the historical precedent of the 1928 presidential campaign when Alfred E. Smith, the Democratic governor of New York and a Roman Catholic, was the Democratic nominee, and he lost to Herbert Hoover largely because of religious issues in that campaign. And the other precedent that Kennedy had to deal with was the publication and the popularity of a book by Paul Blanchard called American Freedom and Catholic Power, published in 1949 by Beacon Press in Boston, which was quite popular. It went through several editions, 11 printings in as many months. And what was remarkable about that book was not that this was an anti-Catholic screed, which in many ways it was, arguing that the Roman Catholic Church and Roman Catholicism generally was antithetical to American democratic institutions, but the fact that it had been written by someone who was not a wacko from somewhere, but someone who had advanced degrees from places like the University of Michigan and Columbia University. So it was a respectable, or at least seen as a respectable issue to bring up in 1949, and this book was enormously popular.
What were some of the other things that were set against him because he was Catholic? What were some of the arguments being made then about the dangers of having a Catholic president?
The principal argument was simply that a Roman Catholic, because he owes his obedience finally to the Pope, to the Vatican, would be influenced or might be influenced in his policies by the Vatican. And so Kennedy had to lay that to rest. And he did so finally with this remarkable speech he gave at the Rice Hotel in Houston on September 12, 1960, in which he argued, in effect, that voters should bracket out a candidate's faith when they went into the voting booth.
You reprint some of the anti-Catholic tracts that were published during Kennedy's campaign. Let me read a couple of excerpts of things that were published. That a Roman Catholic president in the White House is the next step planned by the hierarchy of enthroned cardinals, bishops, and priests. Help us defeat the Roman political machine from making America Catholic. Don't let any Catholic convince you that his oath to his state or government comes first. A Catholic is bound to his church from infancy. How much traction did these things have?
I think it had quite a bit. Anecdotal evidence that I uncovered at the JFK Library and other places indicated that these tracts, these broadsides, were circulating fairly widely within the countryside. And just before the voting in many Protestant churches is so-called Reformation Sunday, which, of course, commemorates Martin Luther's nailing of the 95 Theses to the cathedral door at Wittenberg on October 31st, 1517. And this was the occasion for a kind of last-minute, last-gasp appeal by many Protestant ministers arguing that their people should not vote for a Roman Catholic for president.
On the other side, there were religious groups that said religion shouldn't be an issue when it comes to electoral politics. There was a group called the Fair Campaign Practices Committee, which included rabbis, Catholics, Protestant leaders. George Romney was one of the members, the father of Mitt Romney, who went on himself to become governor of Michigan in 62. They prepared a special statement on religion in the 1960 campaign. Can you give us a sense of what it said?
It said, in effect, that we should disregard or at least discount a candidate's religious preferences or his religious affiliations as we consider who we're going to vote for president. And they were trying to, in effect, guarantee the rights of minority religious groups that they would have equal access to elective office, including the presidency.
And how effective was their statement?
I think that was part of a growing reaction in the 1960 campaign to all of this anti-Catholic rhetoric and all of this anti-Kennedy rhetoric. So I think it was part of a reaction. And in fact, when the Protestant ministers gather at the Mayflower Hotel just after Labor Day in the 1960 campaign and issue a press conference or conduct a press conference afterwards trying to call attention to the Catholic issue, I think that the reaction was fairly significant on the part of the public, saying, how dare you raise these issues? And in fact, one of the reporters asked Norman Vincent Peale, well, did you guys discuss Nixon's Quakerism and how that might affect his conduct as president? And Peale responded with an utterly unintentionally funny remark that turned out, in fact, to be quite prophetic. He said, in effect, that Nixon never let his faith bother him in any way.
Well, tell us more about this group that became known as the Peale Group that gathered at the Mayflower Hotel.
The Peale Group really has its origins in the previous month, in August of 1960, and even before that. Billy Graham, who of course was Nixon's friend and longtime confidant, had sent a letter to John F. Kennedy, which I came across in the JFK Library, early in August of that year, in which he it was a very friendly letter. He said that there had been rumors that he, Billy Graham, had intended to introduce the so-called religious issue in the fall campaign, and Graham assured Senator Kennedy that he had no intention of doing so. He allowed that he would probably vote for Richard Nixon, his friend, during that fall election, but he was not going to raise the religious issue. About 10 days later, however, Graham convenes a meeting of Protestant ministers in Montreux, Switzerland, including Norman Vincent Peale, who at that time was pastor of the Marble Collegiate Church in New York City, for the purpose of finding ways to deny Kennedy election to the presidency in November. Coming out of that meeting in Switzerland, then, there's a group of Protestant ministers, and Graham was not at that meeting, but a group of Protestant ministers who meet at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, trying to call attention to Kennedy's faith and how that might affect his conduct as president.
It sounds like Billy Graham was being a little disingenuous. On the one hand, he's saying to Kennedy, well, you know, I have to vote for Nixon because he's my old friend, but if you get elected, I'll help rally everybody to supporting you. But at the same time, he's helping to organize this, like, anti-Kennedy, anti-Catholic group.
I think it's probably fair to say that Billy Graham was being disingenuous with Kennedy, and I don't want to be too hard on him because he's an honorable man. And I think in this case, however, there's clear evidence that Graham, if not reneged, he at least waffled on his pledge to John Kennedy.
And so what did this group do? Like, what action did they actually take?
They didn't take much concrete action, as nearly as I can tell. But the press conference that came out of this meeting, there was 150 ministers gathered at the Mayflower Hotel, so it was a fairly large group. The press conference sought to call attention to that. And there was such a reaction on the part of, first of all, the reporters, but I think Americans generally, to the kind of brazen politicization that this group was engaged in, that I think ultimately it worked to their disadvantage. And Kennedy probably in the end benefited from it. And in fact, the meeting at the Mayflower Hotel was, as nearly as I can tell, the immediate catalyst for Kennedy deciding to go before the Houston Ministerial Association and give his famous address on why a Catholic can be president of the United States.
Do you think that being Catholic actually affected any of his decisions in the White House?
I don't think it did. I think there's fairly clear evidence that Kennedy made good on his promise to govern as president without trying in any way to inflect his religious views into his policies as president. So I think he was very effective and faithful to his pledge.
Now, you write that after Kennedy tried to remove religion as an issue in the campaign, Nixon kind of brought religion back into the White House. In what way did he bring faith into presidential politics?
I think that Kennedy's speech was so effective in 1960 that what I call the Kennedy paradigm of voter indifference toward a candidate's faith really prevailed, not only in 1960, at least sufficiently so that Kennedy could be elected in 1960, in 64, 68, again in 1972. And one index I would cite for that is that when Mitt Romney's father, George Romney, then the governor of Michigan, ran for the Republican presidential nomination in 1968, no one mentioned his faith. His Mormon faith was not an issue. I think that, ironically, Richard Nixon reintroduces faith to presidential politics in, obviously, a negative and kind of a backhanded way. I think it's impossible to imagine the presidency or even the candidacy of Jimmy Carter, a one-term governor of Georgia, had it not been for Richard Nixon. Americans were tired of the culture of corruption that had surrounded the Nixon administration. They were tired of Nixon's endless prevarications. And here you have an outsider to Washington, a Southern Baptist Sunday school teacher coming out of nowhere, not a Washington insider, promising never knowingly to lie to the American people, wanting a government as good and decent as the American people. And the voters ate it up.
So you're saying Nixon brought faith back into presidential politics by being morally corrupt, that people wanted to vote for somebody who they felt had a moral sense from their religion. But on the other hand, you say Nixon instituted worship services in the White House. He brought Billy Graham to the White House to conduct services. Billy Graham offered a prayer at Nixon's inauguration in which he thanked God that thou hast permitted Richard Nixon to lead us at this momentous hour of history. And he instituted worship services in the White House. Can you talk about the impact of that?
I think it's hard to escape the impression that those measures that Nixon took with the White House worship services in particular were anything but political theater. And in fact, Chuck Colson has a memorandum that I quote in the book where he says that he had been instructed by either Nixon himself or Haldeman, I forget now who had done this, to invite in effect, wealthier Republican donors as a kind of inducement for them to provide further support, financial and otherwise, to Nixon, especially as he approached re-election in 1972. I think it would be very hard, and I certainly haven't run across any historian prepared to argue that Nixon was a deeply pious and devout man whose piety, whose understanding of the faith really was reflected in his policies as president.
Jimmy Carter was the first self-identified evangelical president. When you reread or listen back to things that he said when he was campaigning for the White House, what do you hear that you think you wouldn't have quite got then? Things that may sound different to us now that religion has so permeated presidential politics?
I like to joke at times that when Jimmy Carter declared on the eve of the South Carolina primary in 1976 that he was a born-again Christian, he sent every journalist in New York scurrying to his Rolodex trying to figure out what in the world he meant by that. And in fact, the national press, the media, were utterly unprepared for a comment like that and didn't know what to make of it. Now that sort of language, of course, has become commonplace in American presidential politics. People talk about conversion experiences. People talk about being born again. But at the time, at least for the national media, that was something novel. I think the important dimension of the Carter campaign in 1976 was that he was able to lure many evangelicals out of their apolitical torpor. Ever since the Scopes trial of 1925, evangelicals had been politically quiescent for a number of reasons. One of them was simply that they felt that the larger culture was corrupt and not worth paying attention to, and certainly politics was corrupt. Jimmy Carter, using this language of being a born-again Christian, and I remember this very clearly myself as having grown up as an evangelical, we paid attention. This was new. This was exciting that one of our own was actually mounting a credible campaign for the presidency. And Carter is able to lure enough evangelical voters back into the political arena, Southerners especially, but others as well, that it really made a difference, I think, in the 1976 presidential campaign.
But then many of those evangelical voters became disillusioned with Carter.
I think that is the great irony of presidential politics over the last century, is what happened then. Very quickly, prodded by politically conservative activists, evangelicals turn against Jimmy Carter. And what I try to expose in the book, and I think I document copiously, is that the religious right did not coalesce as a political movement in direct response to the Roe v. Wade decision of 1973. Catholics were already on board on the anti-abortion movement well before Roe v. Wade. But it was not an issue for evangelicals. In fact, the Southern Baptist Convention, which is hardly a bastion of liberalism, had passed a resolution calling for the legalization of abortion. And this was a resolution that was reaffirmed in 1974, again in 1976. It was not the abortion issue. What galvanized evangelicals as a political bloc, as a political movement, was instead the actions of the Internal Revenue Service to go after the tax-exempt status of Bob Jones University in Greenville, South Carolina, because of its racially discriminatory policies. And Carter was unfairly blamed for this by the architects of the religious right, and they used that against him and mobilized to defeat him 4 years later in 1980.
And you're referring to a court decision that said that charitable organizations couldn't qualify for tax exempt status if they demonstrated racial discrimination.
That's right. And
Bob Jones University wanted to retain its tax exempt status, but at the same time, I guess it didn't allow African Americans to become students there or to teach there.
Bob Jones University did not allow African Americans to be enrolled at the school until 1991, and did not allow unmarried African Americans as students until 1995. The lower court ruling that really became the catalyst for the rise of the religious right was a ruling called Green v. Connolly, issued in 1971 by the District Court of the District of Columbia. And it upheld the Internal Revenue Service in its ruling that any organization that engages in racial segregation or discrimination is not, by definition, a charitable organization, and as such has no claim to tax-exempt status. And as the IRS began applying that ruling and enforcing it various places, including Bob Jones University, that is what galvanized evangelical leaders into a political movement that we know today as the religious right.
Randall Baumer recorded earlier this year after the publication of his book, God in the White House. If you could travel back in time, where would you go? That's a question most people have asked themselves at one time or another. Seldon Edwards has spent 30 years working out his answer in his debut novel called The Little Book. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Seldon Edwards' debut novel, The Little Book, has what they call in the publishing biz a great backstory. Edwards began writing the novel in 1974 when he was a newly minted English teacher. During summer vacations, and I would guess tedious faculty meetings over the next 30 years, Edwards kept plugging away at his novel. Now, at long last, the magnum opus has been published. Given that Edwards' tome was some 3 decades in the making and that it amounts to roughly 400 pages of text, a reader would be justified in being a wee bit leery of it. After all, the little book exhibits all the outward signs of being the fiction equivalent of those 8-hour, suck-it-up-for-art, marathon theater productions of Mother Courage. But here's the surprise ending to this backstory. It turns out Edwards was working for a third of a century on something that's fun, a narrative bauble, a veritable meringue of a tale. Not once throughout the little book does Edwards, as one might dread, wedge in a homily on the meaning of life. Instead, he's labored long and hard on a historical time travel fantasy that's an ideal late summer reading getaway, complete with screwball hidden identity plots and even lively background music. Forget Mother Courage. Think Mamma Mia. The little book is all about plot. That's what makes it both an entertaining mental escape and a tough book to do justice to in a review. The minute I begin telling the story, I inevitably spoil some surprises. Therefore, I'll strip the Rococo plot to its bare foundations. On the first page of Chapter 1, we readers meet our hero, middle-aged Wheeler Burden, who has just found himself transported from San Francisco in the year 1988 back to Vienna in 1897. A few pages away from the end of this novel, we find out how and why. In between, we learn, among other things, that in his 20th century life, Wheeler has been a baseball phenom, a rock star who shared the stage with the Stones at Altamont, and a reclusive writer. Life is even more riotous in turn-of-the-century Vienna, where in coffee houses and concert halls, Wheeler, bemused but intrigued, meets youthful versions of his grandparents, listens to Mahler live, and goes into analysis with Sigmund Freud. Wheeler meets other famous or infamous folks, too, but you'll have to grab a copy of Karl Schorska's classic 1982 study, Fin de Siècle Vienna, to puzzle out for yourself whom they might be. I've already said much too much. Edwards handles the hectic demands of a multi-stranded plot with deftness and humor. One of the most amusing subplots involves Wheeler's efforts to support himself while stranded in Vienna. He comes up with the brainstorm of fashioning a wooden prototype for, of all things, the Frisbee. Especially delicious are the scenes in which Edwards imagines Wheeler's sessions with Freud. Of course, the Sage of Vienna regards Wheeler's time travel story as a sign of delusion. Undeterred, Wheeler, with the benefit of hindsight, tries to give Freud a sense of the revolution in consciousness that his work will ignite. "You have been operating in a pristine world," says Wheeler. "Your patients are completely untouched and uncontaminated by psychology. They have never been asked about deep emotions. In school, they were not asked to write about feelings. No one has suggested to women that their ailments might be psychosomatic. In fact, no one in Vienna in 1897 even knows what that word means." A large part of the pleasure in reading time travel tales lies in the jolt a reader experiences when reading a passage like that one. A world without Freud. Imagine. Edwards doffs his hat to Twain's classic time travel tale, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. But in its suspense plot and thickness of detail, the little book is most reminiscent of Jack Finney's magnificent Time and Again, although Edwards' tale lacks the melancholy that graces Finney's book. Instead, the little book is a lot like that frisbee Wheeler tries to bestow upon the world before its time. A soaring thing of joy whose only purpose, and I mean this as a compliment, is to delight and entertain.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Little Book by Selden Edwards. You can read an excerpt of the book and download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.